Good afternoon. My name is Keisha Clark. You are listening to the Andy Zanka Youth Empowerment Program. Thanks for joining us for our monthly youth news show. Today I will be talking to Katie and Kay's eldest DJ, Art Ackerman. We will be discussing Art's passion for swing music, why he likes being a DJ, and some of his life experiences. Welcome to the show, Art.
Well, thank you, Keisha.
Tell us about your radio show and how you fell in love with the music.
Well, it's kind of accidental. I moved to Carbondale in 1985, and I started on a radio, and I can't remember what brought me to it, but in late 1987. And I had these swing records at home, or records from the swing era, and big band era, I call it. Hmm. And KD&K was located in a back room on the second floor of the Dinkle Building at the time. There was a man who had a radio program, and he played music like I liked, jazz, and his name was Gil Kolstock. And so I started alternating him on a weekly basis. He'd do it 1 week, and I'd do it the next week. And we'd get together every once in a while to compare notes. That was it. I had subscribed for the swing records. Like once a month or once every 2 months, I'd get a package with three or four records in it.
And yeah.
So I had the music, and it was just natural to play it over the radio. I guess that was about it. And the studio at that time had was a lot more simpler than it is now. It had a 8-track system. It had a reel-to-reel tape machine. Had two turntables, and we could play cassettes back then. Remember cassettes? Yeah, right. So
nice.
So anyway, I had the material, and I liked to listen to the music. But I, up until that time, I was not. And still I'm not really that well-versed, even though I've been doing it all these years, in music, but I just like to hear it.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of music, I play the kind of music that I liked as a teenager.
So which, what did you listen to when you were a teenager?
Well, I loved the big bands. Miller was, of course, my favorite and everybody's favorite back then. There was Count Basie and Duke Ellington. That was played on the radio. Every week, there was a program called Your Hit Parade, and it was sponsored by Lucky Strike Cigarettes.
Okay.
And I think it was on Saturday nights. It was, I can't remember, probably a half an hour. Might have been an hour program on the radio. We didn't have television back then.
Okay, yeah.
They played the top hits of the week. And right off the chart. So you might hear the same tune every week for 4 or 5 weeks sometimes.
Yeah.
And so I subscribe to those too. And I've been playing those on, maybe once every 4 or 5 weeks.
Nice.
1 year. And when I play them now, I'm donating to the radio station here for the archives. So,
oh, cool. Yeah. So it's like jazz and rock and roll mainly?
No, not rock and roll.
No, no.
No, that's not my favorite.
Oh, dang.
I'm a swing era, and that ended shortly after World War II. So
okay.
Because the big bands pretty much broke up, most of them during the war, because guys went into the service and so forth.
Yeah.
And it's pretty hard to get them back together after the war. Some of them did. So,
yeah?
Yeah.
Nice. So. Some of them were like, yeah, let's continue to make the music.
Anyway, I like to listen to my own program.
Right.
And I send out a playlist to probably at least 100 people every week. So,
what is swing music to be exact?
It's music that you can dance to. And Walt Smith calls it touch dancing because you're holding your partner and you're not. And
so like
back in high school, it was called, we had jitterbugs, jitterbugging. And that was pretty athletic dancing. Yeah. But still not like today.
No.
In fact, back when I was in the Dinkle Building, I remember I had a call, and it was a young voice woman. I think she's probably still in high school. And wow. She said, Mr. Ackerman, I really enjoy that music you're playing. And I said, well, thank you. I really appreciate the call. And she said, can you dance to it?
Well,
and
yeah.
That cracked me up because that was the kind of music we used to dance to.
Yeah, right. Now, I think every now and then when I do listen to swing music, I think it's easier to dance to than what we have nowadays.
Oh, yeah, I'll say.
Yeah.
Well, but it was dancing back then. Now, today it's kind of just, I think of it as jumping up and down.
Yeah, no.
And waving your arms.
I can vouch for that one. It's just mainly jumping up and down. What do you think about popular music today?
I don't like it.
No?
For the most part. Some of it's fine.
Some of it's good. Have you seen Katie and Kay change a lot from when you first started?
Oh, of course. And I just, it's hard for me to believe how far we've advanced. Just sitting here and looking at what we're looking at, and what do we call this, a control room? Or
yeah, all the buttons and electronics up in here, yeah.
And Steve Skinner and Luke have just done a wonderful job.
Yeah.
A lot of responsibility, put in a lot of time.
I bet, with all the cords that are going on around.
And I was on the board of directors a few years ago for 3 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I got all the inside dope.
Yeah. So how did you end up in Carbondale?
Well, that's another, people keep asking me like about that. My wife Carolyn and I came out here with a group, a ski club from Detroit, in 1967 to ski at Snowmass. That was the year it opened. And a lot of stuff wasn't finished at Snowmass back then, but it was so great. And so we came back with another couple the next year. And then somewhere along the line, we brought our kids out here. We have five children. Mm-hmm. And we skied back in Michigan, and we skied up at Mont Tremblant in Canada. And but the kids just fell for it. And the first chance they got, they came out here one by one.
Right.
And so when I retired from my career job in 1985, 84 actually, my son Skip was here building handcrafted log homes, and my son John was working with him, and my daughter Gwen was married to H.P. Hansen, and he had an opportunity to buy 108 acres up on 103 Road, which is called Hawk Ridge now.
Yeah.
And so I bought out as two partners, and he and I were partners, and he did all the hard work, and I put up the money.
Yeah, right.
So I had a property here to build on, and I had a son to build me a beautiful handcrafted log home. So
yeah,
that's the way it worked out, and I had three kids living here.
Yeah, sounds like you got the whole deal.
And I had moved our corporate headquarters out to Southern California back in 1980, and I'd moved out there from Michigan. And so when I retired out there, all my good old boy relationships were back in Michigan, but I had three kids in Carbondale and some property here, so
yeah.
Here I am. I've been here, 31 years now.
Oh, wow.
So.
How have you seen Carbondale change in that time?
Oh, boy, I'll say. And when my kids were first here, before I moved out here, I don't think there was a paved street in town.
No?
Mm-mm.
Just
I remember when
dirt?
They, it was before I moved here, but I remember when they paved Main Street. And it had a peculiar thing. When cars drove down and it went clunk, 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 and they had to fix that.
Wasn't perfect just yet.
But it was young people like you that brought Carbondale alive after, I suppose right around the Korean, or not the Korean War, the... Vietnam War.
Okay.
And I have trouble coming up with words sometimes. I've been to Vietnam twice, but anyway, it was, I would call it, if I want to be slangish about it, maybe Hippieville at that time. Up until that time, it was just a very slow rural town. One of my good friends, Wally DeBeck, was in the Navy in World War II. His grandfather started the town. His grandfather was Mr. Dinkle, and he built the Dinkle Building and so on.
Yeah.
Anyway, when Wally got out of the Navy, he was let off at the edge of town from a truck or whatever he was riding in, and walked into town, and he said the only living thing he saw was a dog sound asleep in the middle of Main Street.
Can't do that now.
No,
no.
The
car is going up and down.
Oh, it's amazing. Just the changes that have happened in the whole valley in the last 30 years is absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
You look at Basalt today, and when we moved here, Basalt was just a main street with old commercial buildings on it, and a street up above where there are old houses.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Yeah. I'm sure it's changed a lot, because, I mean, I would ask.
Well, that's life, you know. Everything changes.
Yeah.
I've changed a little bit.
Right? So, would you mind telling me a little about your youth and career, anything?
Well, I was born in 1925. That makes me 91. And I consider myself the oldest disc jockey in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
But I said that about 5 years ago, and I found out I was the oldest disc jockey this side of Paonia.
Ooh.
Anyway, the Depression came along when I was 5, 6 years old,
mm-hmm.
and one out of every four people was out of work. It was 26%, I think, and it was very tough.
Yeah,
it was very tough for teenagers and people in their 20s because their parents couldn't support them anymore.
No.
And the wonderful thing that happened is the government formed the Civilian Conservation Corps and took all these young men off the railroad cars they were riding around the country on as mm-hmm. hobos and put them in camps where they did wonderful, wonderful construction work, planted forests all over, and people forget about things like that, but you can go anywhere. You go to any one of the national parks and see the wonderful things that are built there, and they were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yeah.
And Michigan had the upper part of the state was completely reforested by the CCC.
Wow.
Anyway, so I grew up. I didn't grow up, but I was a youngster during the Depression, And I went door-to-door selling magazines. I had a paper route. I took three kindergartners, walked them to school every day for 25 cents a week, mowed lawns for 25 cents, but I could get a haircut for 25 cents. So
yeah, it was a lot cheaper back then.
And also worked at a local movie theater by taking the reels of film down to the main lobby and changing the marquee. Then when I went to high school, when I graduated from high school, I had taken the examination, physical and mental examination, for being an aviation cadet, naval aviation cadet. The war was on then, of course.
Yeah.
This was 1943. And while waiting to be called to active duty, I got a job at a company called Gelatin Products. The company today is called R.P. Scherer, who was the owner of Gelatin Products back then. And they were the only company in the world that made sealed gelatin capsules. And that was in Detroit. And I became a capsulation machine operator. And it was kind of interesting because Detroit was the arsenal of democracy, it was called then. And we built everything in Detroit.
Yeah.
Tanks, trucks, you name it. And the war was on, so there was a real shortage of labor. And so kids right out of high school could get a job like that. And
it was kind of easy for them to start working.
And anyway, then I got called into the Navy, and I stayed on active duty in the Navy, got my wings and commission, learned how to fly a dive bomber, and was on active duty for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days. War ended, and so I started at the University of Michigan, and I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but after a year seeing how students in med school had to work past midnight every night, I decided maybe I should take an aptitude test and see if there wasn't something else I was qualified for. So I went to engineering school.
Nice.
And got an engineering degree, bachelor's degree in engineering, and the courses I took enabled me to get a master's in business in one more year. So I I got married in 1948, and I graduated with my master's degree in 1951.
Okay.
And I had a wife, two kids, and 2 degrees. And I started as an industrial engineer for a major public accounting firm in their management services department, and at $300 a month.
$300 a month?
Yeah, it's $3,600 a year with a wife and 2 kids. You can't believe how money has, the inflation we've gone through.
Honestly, that blows my mind.
We just keep printing money in this country.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad.
And it's losing its value, so.
Anyway, later on in my career, I was with a company, and I had a good job. I was executive assistant to the executive vice president, and it was a wonderful company.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a college professor, engineering professor, that was working in a company in another town. I can't remember what his position was. But he called on me and said they had an opening for chief of engineering in that company. So I went up and interviewed, and they offered me the job, and I said, okay, I'll take it. I went back to my boss, and I said, I've taken another job. I'm going to leave the company. And he said, Art, he said, I think you should think this over very carefully. I can envision you making $20,000 a year someday. So I stayed with the company and made everybody at this other company very mad because they didn't follow through with taking a job.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, working with that company, did you successfully get up to 20,000?
I got up past that, but it's amazing what you see. I ended up as president of the company.
Wow.
And but when I see what presidents of CEOs make today, and how what they get when they retire, or when they quit, or when they get fired, you know?
Yeah, right.
They get all this money, and
they get quite a bit.
It was quite a bit different back in 1983.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what good work and loyalty can give you. Huh?
I'll say. One thing I learned was you, in your job, you should always have somebody working for you that's able to take your place. Because when I was doing work for clients of this public accounting company and their management services, mm-hmm. we'd go looking for people to fill a key job in a company. And so often I heard, well, Joe would be perfect for that. The client saying, Joe would be perfect for that job, but we don't have anybody to take his place.
Yeah.
No, when you've got somebody working for you and he knows that someday he's going to take your place, he works so hard, you don't have to work. You don't even have to learn the job.
Oh.
He does all the work.
Yeah.
And he's capable. So anyway, that's one key. Another key is that I learned is you should always have a goal. Always have a goal. And you can change goals, but never give up one goal until you got another one. And go for it.
So we'll always have a backup?
Yep.
Well, I like it.
Just go for a goal, you know.
Yeah.
And that puts you on a real good path.
Mm-hmm.
You'll succeed. So,
that's actually anyway, good information.
I have 5 kids. They're all very successful.
Good.
And happy. And I have 11 grandchildren. And I have 3 great-grandchildren and 1 on the way.
Oh, wow.
So.
Lots of children.
You betcha. And I moan about the population explosion.
Right.
Anyway, anything else you'd like to know?
Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I think that's about it. Although, I didn't mention Andy Zanka. Well, I have to tell you, Keisha, about Andy Zanka.
Mm-hmm.
He was a young kid. I don't know if he was 11 or 12 years old. And after school, every day he was at the radio station over when we were in the Dinkle building. He fell in love with radio. And I think probably he eventually had some kind of a program. And he unfortunately ended his life when he was about 20, 21 years old for some reason. But he had a different mindset, obviously, falling in love with something way above,
yeah.
You know. And so that's why Andy Zanka program is in existence today in memory of him and trying to inspire kids, young people like you, to have the inspiration or whatever you call it for radio and enjoy doing it as I do.
Yeah.
Anyway, so ends the program.
Yeah, so ends the program.
And thanks, Keisha.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Keisha Clark, and we've been talking with Art Ackerman, KD&K's eldest DJ. Thanks for listening to the Andy Zanka Youth Empowerment Program.